Right, good afternoon everyone, and welcome to the third session of this year's summer school on protest. And what we've got lined up for this session here is a debate concerning the Occupy movement. So of all the protest movements which have been around in sort of recent years, the Occupy movement has taken a lot of people by surprise. It's had a lot of energy, and it's got a lot of people asking questions that maybe they might not have asked before. So obviously it's only right that we have a session devoted to the Occupy movement in this year's summer school. So very kindly, Ian Barker, who's been involved in Occupy Norwich, has agreed to speak about his own experiences. Please don't assume he sort of represents the Occupy movement as a whole, because in a movement as diverse as that, it's bound to encompass lots of different views and lots of different points of lots of different opinions. So I think it's only fair to say that Ian can only sort of represent his own views, and obviously the experiences that he's had in Occupy Norwich as well, of what he's seen. Obviously he can't sort of represent the Occupy movement as a whole. And to give his own and the SPGB's perspective is Stair, who again is from the same sort of part of the country as Ian. He's based in Norwich as well, so they might have sort of seen sort of how the Occupy movement affected that part of the world. So what we'll do is we'll start off with Ian giving his own thoughts, opinions, and views, and then Stair will give a few minutes to speak about the movement himself, and then after both people have spoken separately, then we'll open up the floor to questions and discussion. Okay, right, so I'd like to introduce Ian Barker from Occupy Norwich.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much to Mike for inviting me here today. As you're probably aware, Occupy was a global protest movement inspired by Occupy Wall Street, which in turn drew inspiration from the Arab Spring and via the Indignados of Spain. Occupy was a truly global phenomenon, with over 1,000 occupations worldwide and around 30 in the UK. Starting from the day of global occupation on the 15th of October, I spent 7 weeks camping in the centre of my home city of Norwich. During that time, I spoke to hundreds of members of the public about their views on society and about why we were there. I was also involved in almost all of the consensus discussions and most of the political working groups at Occupy Norwich. I can only speak with any authority as to what happened and what was discussed at Occupy Norwich, but it is perhaps illustrative of the issues that were raised at other camps and what they were like, especially perhaps the other smaller ones in the UK outside London. Also, obviously, it's inherently going to be a subjective view, but I will try and tell you all the things that were discussed, whether they were things that I agree with myself or not. As best I can, I intend to give you a broad idea of the broad range of political opinions that were current at Occupy Norwich. I'd also like to talk about the successes and failures of the Occupy movement in general, and Occupy Norwich in particular, and say a little bit about how social change might come about. I should perhaps start by explaining my connection with the Occupy movement. Occupy Wall Street started on the 17th of September 2011. The mainstream media was largely silent about it. But in the following months, hints of what was happening began to come out. The strongest hints came, for me anyway, from reading handwritten placards in the background of the few news reports that there were. A few things seemed clear, that in the world of astroturfing, here was a genuine grassroots movement. It was not a narrow single interest group. It spoke about deep-rooted problems in our society, problems which were simply never mentioned in the mainstream media, problems which at that time I felt isolated in recognising. Time would tell that perceptions as to what Occupy Wall Street was about differed greatly. To an extent, my initial reaction to that was that we needed to establish exactly what it was about. I wanted to say, look, this is what Occupy Wall Street's really about, or this is what it should be about. But to a certain extent, that reaction was a ridiculous one. Human society is far too complex to be amenable to the simple, those kind of simple narratives that we tend to try and apply to it. This doesn't mean it's futile to attempt to apply any such narrative. On the contrary, I believe it's essential to do so. However, it's also essential to realise that whatever understanding we might have is just that, a narrative, an attempt to make sense of something complex. And that while it might be useful, especially in certain contexts, it's certainly flawed and does not necessarily invalidate other understandings. This fits with a broader philosophical view that we cannot, as individuals, know any absolute truths. Not simply that we don't know what the we're not that we simply can't be certain of what the truth is, but that no concept we can hold in our heads can actually be true. It's only a flawed model of reality. So one useful understanding doesn't necessarily invalidate another one that may at first seem somewhat at odds with it. And that was certainly something that was important to understand at Occupy, because there were so many people with so many different views. In a forum like this, I imagine all of you, to a certain extent, know where each other are coming from in terms of ideology or way of thought. You've got some, at very least, shared terminology and so forth. So you understand where you're coming from. But in Occupy, there was so many people from all different, coming from all different directions, trying to reach consensus, trying to agree what the problems with society were and the direction they should get, that it should go in. This isn't to say that all truths are equal. Some understandings of the world are clearly more useful than others. I'd love to be able to give you an all-encompassing explanation that weaves together all the threads that were present at Occupy Norwich. However, I can find no such overarching narrative. That doesn't invalidate the individual threads, though they are weaker alone, but they are perhaps truer. That plurality of ideas is perhaps suggested by the slogan, "What is our one demand?" I think, however, it is possible to categorise the main concerns of people involved in Occupy Norwich and perhaps the wider movement. I divide them into five main categories: banks, broader economic structure and capitalism, corporations, environment, and conspiracy theories. I'll start by addressing the one that to me is of least importance, conspiracy theories. It has to be said that Occupy Norwich did attract plenty of conspiracy theorists, and for that matter more than its fair share of lunatics. Conspiracy theorists is a slightly problematic heading because it could, at worst, be just a label to put on anything I don't believe. But I think we can pin it down more clearly than that. The other topics I'll cover may not be as well understood by the public as they should be and need to be, but in most cases they do not seem to be actively hidden or literally require hidden conspiracies. There's often little evidence for conspiracy theories, and that there is has not been looked at sceptically. Certainly adherents do not tend to apply Occam's razor. Conspiracy theories suggested include chemtrails, Masons, Illuminati, 9/11 conspiracies, JFK, lizards. You familiar with the lizards? Yeah, well, I'm not sure I actually came across anyone who defended that one. Free man on the land and global warming denial. To put this in context, the Occupy movement was new, non-hierarchical and open. We were in a public space. No one had more claim to know about or to represent the Occupy movement than anyone else. This was at the same time a weakness and a great strength. Overall, I believe it was a wonderful aspect, but it did mean that anyone could come along and spout any old nonsense, and they often did. One example was a chap who claimed that Prince Charles drank children's blood. A remarkable claim, but I tried to keep an open mind, so I asked him why he believed that. He told me that he read in the Daily Mail that Vlad the Impaler drank children's blood. Vlad the Impaler is royal. So is Prince Charles. Therefore, Prince Charles drinks human's blood. You can probably spot the logical fallacy. Don't ever believe anything you read in the Daily Mail.
Go on.
Anyway, I've said more than enough about conspiracy theories, but I do feel that they needed to be mentioned to honestly reflect the topics that were discussed. One aspect of conspiracy theories was that they all tended to give credence to all, or almost all, of the theories, and that included global warming denial. The two certainly seem to go hand in hand. That leads me to another major topic of the Occupy movement, the environment. It was clear to most people that Occupy Wall Street was not primarily about the environment, but it was also abundantly clear that environmental problems are all too relevant. It seems at least that narrow free market capitalism or neoconservative ideology has no solution whatsoever to environmental problems, and those environmental problems are all too real. The problems of habitat destruction, pollution and loss of biodiversity are pressing enough. Humans are certainly still a part of an ecosystem and very much depend on it for our survival, food and oxygen being two rather obvious requirements that are provided by plants. It may be possible for man to live outside nature, or at least with nature only under his dominance, planted monocultures, etc. But do we actually want to live like that? It's certainly the case that overall humanity is rapidly degrading nature. There are, however, some glimmers of hope in that regard, at least in our own culture, the value of these things is increasingly recognised and many environments are improving in the UK. These environmental problems, I'm inclined to call the mundane environmental challenges. Most of them can largely be addressed at a comparatively local level, and the benefits and penalties will be felt locally. Global warming is different. Carbon dioxide emitted here and now will, in about 7 years' time, be well mixed around the globe, or at least the airborne fraction of it. We are all in the same boat when it comes to climate change. We are not all equally to blame, but we all share the consequences. This is nearly unique in human history. Climate change does not seem to be discussed nearly as much as it needs to be in the mainstream media, so I'll just mention a few facts that give a fair flavour of the seriousness of failing to act. International conferences have agreed that we should be aiming for 2 degrees C of warming. However, there's little or no agreement or progress to achieving those or known ways of doing so. Many commentators think that we're likely heading towards 4 degrees of warming. This may not seem like much, but to put it in context, do you know what the average global temperature, the difference in average global temperature between current interglacials and glacials was? What would we have over there?
12.7.
Oh, right, the 7's right. It's about 6 or 7 degrees, so it kind of puts the possible amounts of global warming into context when you've got a 7 degree average difference leading to woolly mammoths, etc., versus now. Obviously, the temperature difference then wasn't uniform over the entire globe. There were more extremes in various places, and exactly the same will be true of global warming, with interiors of continents likely to see double the average warming. So, for example, for a 4 degrees change, the interior of the US or Australia may well see 8 degrees of change. Another fact that seems underappreciated is that we don't simply need to reduce CO2 emissions. For example, we need to pretty much eliminate them entirely. About 10% of the world's average CO2 emissions is about the level we need to reach in order for the planet to be able to absorb the amount of CO2 emitted and therefore stop temperatures continually increasing. And when you actually consider how much fossil fuels are used in every aspect of our lives, the fact that radical change needs to be coming one way or another seems fairly obvious. And obviously that has broader implications for social issues. We can't carry on going the way we are going. One of the conclusions of Occupy Norwich fairly early on was that to tackle climate change, we needed to tackle social inequality. It's an too important area where free market capitalism has no answers, and even states seem failed to deal with an inherently global problem. There is some synchronicity in the fact that the Occupy movement was perhaps the first truly global protest movement at a time when the world faces a truly global problem. That problem is clearly exacerbated by vast amounts of money spent on PR by corporations with vested interests in the status quo. Banking was another major theme of Occupy. Many people seem to believe that banks were able to create money out of nothing, then lend it to people and collect all the interest. A consequence of this banking magic was that there was simply not enough money in existence to pay back all the loans. This is highly inaccurate. I think my mantra during the time at Occupy Norwich was every borrowing creates a deposit. Banks do create money, in that every time they loan someone money it's used to buy something and is then deposited, it creates money that wasn't there previously, but it is always balanced by a loan. Loans are always balanced by a deposit. Banks don't simply collect interest. They're largely a means of passing it from one party to another. I'm happy to go into a lot more detail in banking if you wish, because we did in Occupy Norwich, but to a certain extent I'm not sure it led us anywhere other than to realise that there was a depositor at the other end of each loan, which is something I arrived at Occupy Norwich understanding. Of course, banks cannot just make up money as they please. If they could, there would have been no need for a bank bailout. There is enough money in the system to pay off all the loans, only, almost by definition, it isn't in the hands of those with debts. There is an instability in the banking system, which comes from the way banks create not money, but liquidity. As I'm sure you're aware, base money, notes, coins, deposits on account at the Bank of England is only a fraction of total savings, banks do not hold enough cash to pay all their depositors should they decide to make a withdrawal. In theory, banks should hold assets equal to their liabilities, their liabilities being the savings of depositors. Those assets, the assets will generally be loans. From the point of view of a bank, a loan is an asset. So the value of assets and loans must match for a bank to be solvent, but liquidity generally does not match. Loans are often for a term of 25 years, in the case of mortgages, whereas savings will rarely be fixed for more than 5 years. And even then, they'll normally still be accessible at a penalty. So banks do magic liquidity out of thin air. In theory, this should not be a problem provided they're solvent, as the Bank of England is supposed to act as lender of last resort and provide solvent banks with liquidity in the form of loans of base money. The problem comes when there's a threat or a run on a bank. Sorry, threat of a run on a bank. The Bank of England would then, in theory, have to assess the solvency of that bank, which means assessing the quality of its loans. In essence, the Bank of England, in the case of a run on a bank, is required to perform the whole useful function of that bank. However, I think the problem with RBS, Lloyds and others was not simply lack of liquidity, but they were actually insolvent. There is a tendency to see the economic problems as symptoms of a banking problem, rather than the other way round. That's certainly the way many people involved with Occupy Norwich viewed it. Indeed, this view seemed so prevalent at times that I wondered if I was in the wrong movement. I was reassured that at least the defining slogan of Occupy Wall Street does not fit this interpretation too well. We are the 99% and the rest are bankers. It doesn't really work. Not that I don't think there wasn't a problem with banking. There clearly were plenty of problems. But was that the primary cause of the economic problems that people face? My view is that the underlying structure of society is more to blame. The problem, as one senior member of Occupy Norwich put it, that wealth tends to run uphill. That is very clearly how money and banking works. I suspect I don't need to talk to you much about the underlying mechanisms, about the way that wealth begets wealth, and those with the most get more, while those with the least scrape along the bottom. At least after, I think that after World War II, that was something that was broadly recognised in society. And the welfare state was a conscious means of redressing that imbalance. It brought with it, in minutiae, some of the problems of state capitalism, but combined some of the undeniable freedoms of free market capitalism, or combined with some of the undeniable freedoms of free market capitalism, created a balance that was far preferable to either system unalloyed. One of the most convincing efforts to draw together the banking and broader capitalist threads is to see the expansion of consumer credit as having helped mask and increase the increasing problems caused by inequality, while in the long term only exacerbating them. Viewed in this light, banking failures were inevitable. An important concept that I'd like to mention here is the confluence of environmental concerns for our finite planet and the problems of capitalism. In a sense, if the Earth's resources were infinite, if we lived on an infinite planet, the acquisition of capital would not be a problem, at least provided freedom from direct oppression could be assured. It's the acquisition of limited resources that causes real problems with the private exploitation of natural monopolies and the diminution by government legislation of the ability of people to provide for themselves. An extreme and well-known example of the latter being the right to charge for collecting rainwater being given to a private company in Bolivia. Norwich has a long history of resistance against the ills of capitalism, going right back perhaps to the start of capitalism. In 1549, Robert Kett led a rebellion against enclosure. We at Occupy Norwich marked the anniversary of his hanging at Norwich Castle on the 7th of December. Enclosure is important, as it's a tangible moment when the people of this country lost their feudal land rights yet gained no ownership rights. Modern statistics show that half of the population have virtually no wealth at all. It's worth noting that this is not necessarily the result of squandering resources, but rather that many of these families have never had property rights in the modern post-feudal sense. Another important theme was corporations. Not only as large concentrations of capital, the difference between a corporation and a wealthy, or a difference between a corporation and a wealthy individual is that the individual may at least have some normal human compassion and emotions. A corporation does not. They pursue profit alone, require their employees, management in particular, to act only in the interest of profit. Studies show that the prevalence of psychopathic characteristics among CEOs is four times that of the population at large. Large corporations display many of the negative aspects of government, inflexible, inhuman bureaucracy combined with great power. If you could just avoid corporations, that might not be such a problem, but they're keen to manipulate law and legislators to create and control monopolies. Another aspect of corporations pursuing profit rather than the common good is built-in redundancy. It's just one example where the paths of maximum profit and maximum well-being are clearly divergent. Advertising was perhaps the most under-discussed topic at Occupy Norwich, but its role in provoking over-consumption of goods that do not fulfil the purchaser but profit those selling them, while adding to environmental destruction, was certainly noted. But advertising is just one aspect of how money can buy thought. So many think tanks, especially in the US, are simply mouthpieces for the interests of their wealthy benefactors. Yet they may appear at first sight benign, non-profit organisations. The media will gladly regurgitate much of their output along with that of PR companies, simply because it's easy and cheap to do so, not to mention the bias inherent in a media largely owned by the wealthy. I've briefly covered a lot of topics, and a great deal more could be said of all of them, but it does hopefully give you a flavour of the things that were discussed at Occupy Norwich, and perhaps the broader movement as well. I've tried to give them proportionate weight to the time that was spent on them at Occupy Norwich. What we've been talking about are mostly the topics and ideas that were discussed amongst the people who probably regarded themselves as part of Occupy, as opposed to the wider public. We tried hard, especially in the early days, not to create a divide between us occupiers and the general public. I think this was important and worked well, at least for a while, not least because we were just people who had spontaneously come together as a result of the Occupy movement. Personally, I didn't know any of the people who were also occupying the Haymarket in Norwich before we'd come together on that day to do so. We tried to avoid an us and them divide by simple things like orientation of a table so that it wasn't entirely clear which side the occupiers would stand versus the public. We didn't stand behind a desk telling people how it was, which I fear I'm slightly doing now. we talked with them, and hopefully we'll have a bit of discussion in a mo. I certainly spoke individually to hundreds of people just who came up to ask what it was about and why we were there, and for me that was one of the most powerful aspects of it, just simple one-to-one human interaction and discussion about politics and society, which all too rarely happens, especially between a diverse set of people who don't necessarily agree on anything before they start having a conversation. Language is, in doing that and discussion in general, we found that language is very important. In theory, we all speak English and understand the same thing from the same words. However, it seems that often that's far from the case. Two people will tend to take very different meanings from any statement. In particular, I felt it was important to use new ways of expressing concepts. In particular, trotting out old left-wing clichés seemed it would just close the minds of the people we needed to reach. So often it seems that very disparate people would really hold much the same views, but could easily end up arguing like mad because they misunderstood one another. An extreme example from an early monetary reform working group was a chap called Oliver. He argued for ages that the amount of wealth in an economy was constant. I eventually realised that what he actually meant was energy. I suggested this might be the case, and it seemed to solve the problem. We never saw him again, but at least the discussion could proceed. The general public were amazingly supportive, especially in the early days. They brought us food and anything else we needed. Those that spoke to us were, of course, a self-selecting sample. But of that group, the vast majority supported us, with only the occasional one or two shouting something derogatory as they walked past. However, even they, if chased after and engaged in conversation, tended to be persuadable that we might have a case for being there. One thing I would note about public opinion of all the people I spoke to, one almost absolute constant was their opposition to recent wars. And if it does come to the point that our government's mad enough to think that attacking Iran might be a good idea, I know for damn certain that practically every single person I spoke to in Norwich would be against such a thing, and that all that's required is for people to show their will if it comes to such a thing. One thing that reassured me a great deal is that right to protest, in Norwich at least, is very much intact. The police weren't any trouble at all. The only real concern seemed to be that bylaws preventing drinking were upheld. There was only one arrest that I'm aware of at Occupy Norwich, and that was a drunk Lithuanian who didn't have any trousers on. The reaction of the local council was interesting. They claimed ownership of the public space on which we recount. I believe they did not want to be seen to be supporting us, but did not want to be seen to be opposing us either. I got the very strong sense that they were extremely sensitive to public opinion, as they should be. Their inaction was, I believe, because we had a good measure of public support. The right to protest is an essential aspect of democracy. The absolute right to protest in the tent is harder to justify. It certainly gave Occupy Norwich momentum and continuity, which it would have been hard to achieve otherwise. But it did also cause many problems. Over time, the camp attracted the homeless and drug addicts. It was also a place to hang out for young people, some with little interest in politics. There was free food, drinks and shelter. There was much debate in the camp about how and to what extent we should try and exclude such people. Did we even have the right to ask them to leave when it was essentially a public space? It was further complicated by there being no clear dividing line as to who we might exclude and who not. Eventually, the effort of trying to keep the camp at a standard where I felt we had a right to maintain it became too much for me, and I left after about 2 months. I continued to support the camp as there were still many people there for genuine reasons. Another reason personally I had to leave at that point was I'd spent so much time open-mindedly listening to what other people thought that I was rather lost as to what I actually thought myself at that point. The camp gradually degraded as winter took hold, to the extent that by the time the council indicated that they were ready to take legal action to remove the camp in February, the vast majority of those involved wanted the camp to close. At this point, consensus, which had been a powerful aspect of Occupy, became somewhat of a curse. I probably should say a little about consensus. You're all familiar with how consensus works as a method of decision making? Okay, well, yeah, we'll say a bit about that. I mean, obviously, it's as opposed to simple majority voting or whatever. So if we wanted to reach agreement on an issue, rather than talk until half of the people agreed, we'd talk until pretty much everyone agreed. And that's actually a very, very powerful aspect, because it's almost not so much that consensus is useful for making decisions, it's useful for bringing people together so that they have a shared understanding of something. But bringing them together with a shared understanding, not simply by discussion, by sharing ideas. And that worked really quite well in a lot of ways. We certainly reached agreement amongst a wide group of diverse people on several points. So I can read you the consensus things that were agreed at the General Assembly of Occupy Norwich. If you're interested, in fact, I will read them out because they're very much what everyone at Occupy Norwich agreed on. Wealth inequality is too great. That was agreed. The House of Commons does not represent the will or interests of the common people, rather than the wealthy. We want a fairer, more sustainable system. And there were a large number actually originating from the Climate Change Working Group. You know, we cannot conceive of a way to reduce global warming without an increase in global equality. An increase in global equality is not enough on its own to fight global warming. We need a cultural shift to reduce energy use. This cultural shift should include a reduction in consumerism to reduce output and hence emissions. We need to be valued for things other than material wealth. Humans should enhance nature rather than degrade it. Just gone off on one there. Consensus. Consensus was wonderful for actually bringing about genuinely sort of group-held beliefs. But when it came to the final act, as it were, and the requirement to make a decision as to take down the camp, we failed to reach a decision because there were about five people who wished to keep the camp going, and the rest of the people who didn't. And perhaps given enough time and calmness, we would have reached consensus. It certainly had happened the previous week. A decision had been made by consensus with about 30 people that we would close the camp, all of them agreeing. Although the following week, five people turned up and and wanted to keep it going. The rather unsatisfactory result that, that it was not until the court order was granted for the removal of the camp that that everyone accepted that the camp would close, and it was left to a few of us to try and clear up as much as possible of what remained in the 24 hours before the court order took effect. That rather ignominious end to the camp shouldn't, in my view, overshadow what it was, or what it, like the 30 or so other camps around the country and thousands around the world, achieved. It created a forum for people to directly discuss society, economics and politics, where money wasn't required to participate at an equal level. It acted as a highly visible symbol that there is popular discontent at the course of society. And I do believe that the only reason these camps were able to stay was that they had public support. So in effect, they were a symbol of that. I also believe their influence shouldn't be underestimated. It certainly, for a while, changed the tone of political dialogue. Personally, I believe that direct person-to-person contact and the exchange of ideas was the essential element. We would occasionally appear in the local media, TV or newspapers, etc. But once passed through the media filter, it seemed to lose any meaning, whereas direct interactions with people did have real meaning. Unfortunately, I think that such a camped protest on public spaces is unlikely to be easily tolerated again in the near future. But that, of course, depends on circumstance and public attitude. The importance for me of Occupy was the transfer of ideas and understanding directly between people. There's no question that the 99% have all the power. If they collectively know what they want to do and that enough others feel the same, it will happen. But reaching this agreement is hard in the extreme. So many people are simply not interested in politics at all, but I must confess to having only little hope of direct parliamentary solutions or sudden large-scale social change. For myself, I've concluded that the best hope is perhaps to find better ways of living and organising in small groups, both to enjoy life and to demonstrate alternatives. I'm now involved in a project with others, MetadON, to create an intentional community of low-impact, low-cost autonomous housing, as well as another group which sprang out of Occupy Norwich, hoping to help communities in Norwich increase their resilience to further economic problems, government cuts, and to help with the challenges of the changes required to mitigate climate change. I now know a lot more interesting, radical and good people, and I'm hopeful for the future. Thank you.
Right, thank you very much to Ian for giving us a very detailed and clear picture of what the Occupy movement in Norwich meant to him. Please hold on to any questions or discussion points you want to make for the time being.